Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, welcome to an edition of Speaking of Reliability. This is Adam Barrett.
Hello, Adam. This is John Krucher.
Hey, John. How's it going?
It's going well, Adam. How are you?
Good, good. So in this episode, we were planning on talking a little bit about qualitative versus quantitative testing, which is always a great topic because it can go in so many directions as, you know, regarding exactly what component of that comparison we want to talk about.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun topic because it kind of hits, in my opinion anyways, it hits the core of what a lot of us do, right, as reliability engineers. I mean, we spend a lot of our time doing one or the other. I mean, of course, there's a lot more to reliability engineering than that, but, you know, at the core of it, we're generally doing one or the other.
Yep. All right, well, I'll put you on the spot. What's your definition for each of those?
Okay, so I think of qualitative reliability assessment as something you do earlier in the development cycle, first of all, on a product that's perhaps less mature, where you are basically just trying to run it through its paces on some kind of a highly accelerated test environment, just to find and fix things, you know, just to get the low-hanging fruit, if you will. You know, HALT is an example, you know, the most obvious example, I guess, highly accelerated life test. HALT has got there's some rigor and, you know, as to how you conduct a HALT, but it doesn't have to be that test. It can, in my opinion, in my experience, qualitative assessments can be anything that's highly accelerated. It can be step stress testing. They can be really any test in your test arsenal that's accelerated to a great deal. With the central focus is just, in my opinion, finding and fixing failure modes. That is as opposed to the quantitative side, from my experience, is further on in the development cycle. So you got a more mature product. You got a product that's already been evolved to some extent. You know, it's been through a few cycles. And at this point, you're doing some quantitative work because, for example, perhaps you have a reliability specification that you need to meet, whether it's spec defined by regulatory pressures or a customer requirement or some kind of internal requirement. But in this case, you're meeting reliability and confidence goal, and you have some test cycle and test duration that's defined and rigorously defined based on customer environments and exposures. And then of course, based on the reliability and confidence specifications, you've got test sample sizes highly defined in order to meet those requirements.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how does that line up with your, you know, general sense of the two?
Yeah, it does. I agree with that. I mean, if I was to put a single word definition to each, I would say qualitative is comparative. You're comparing it to how you want it to perform or, you know, how another unit has performed, what it looks like. And then quantitative is measurement. You're measuring it to usually compare against a numerical value.
Yeah, in the quantitative side, you're often doing it because you want some kind of measure. You know, I mean, you can essentially get your product to a very robust, durable stage in the qualitative world, but, you know, you can't. It's hard to then speak to a prospective customer, for example, or perhaps management, and give them a number, you know, that reflects the durability of your product. So that's where the quantitative side comes in, right? So you want something, some kind of representative exposure, test exposure with a rigorously defined test plan, and then you can say, yep, we just demonstrated whatever it is, right? R97C70.
Right, right. Well, yeah, that's the classic, you know, if you stop with just qualitative in development, you know, management wants to know, is projects going along? You know, how is reliability going? And they answer, oh, really good. You know, it means nothing. Like, that's just totally, you know, or you say, no, we need more test units. And then you can, they just, the argument goes back and forth. No, you don't. Yes, we do. So yeah, it's not to where you can actually give numeric values that either compare against a previously established goal, where you had previously said when you did start of the program, we want to be a 60% statistical confidence at this phase. And, you know, then when you get to that phase, they say, where are we at? And you're like, we're at 40%. And they know they'll be like, uh-oh, okay, what's going on? Or you say, yeah, we're at 65%. They're like, all right, fine, next topic. So it helps create a clarity in a language, I believe, between the core technical team and people outside of it who are helping with decisions, or you're giving input to help them make decisions.
Yeah, I like that. I like how you're putting that. I mean, that it's a language to communicate with all functions that, you know, most people can understand, you know, on a pretty basic level, right? If you've got some kind of numbers that you can give them. But, you know, as you say, you know, even though the qualitative side doesn't provide you with, you know, some metrics, at least not, you know, easily understood metrics that everybody can understand, you quite often are able to do a whole lot of the heavy lifting in that stage, right? So you can really get your product quite mature. It's just that you just can't claim any kind of a numerically any kind of maturity of the product.
Right, right. And the other thing too is funny, and we had a previous conversation on specifications, is that a lot of times the qualitative, you can do a lot of testing without really getting too nitpicky on the specifications, right? Because you run it as how you think it would run, or, you know, in this use case or that use case. But when you're really doing it quantitatively, where you want to measure something, it forces a lot of refinement in what you consider to be a use case, or what exactly a failure is, you know, a soft fail, a hard fail. And I think that just the act of engaging in a quantitative phase can help bring a lot of discussions to the front that can help with avoiding surprises. If you stopped with just how you think it'll be run, or the person designing the test thinks it'll be run, you may find out that the customer runs it very differently, and you have these failures that you totally didn't assess or defend against. When you start with a quantitative phase, you kind of are like, okay, what exactly is a failure? What do we count as one? What do we not? We want to demonstrate a good confidence. Okay, let's try to further evaluate how the customer does use it. And you might be asking some questions that are help define things that were assumed to have been clarified previously but weren't.
Right. Right. I think it's on both ends. It's like as you say, on the qualitative side, it's okay. In fact, it's probably optimum not to be too tied up in how well does this test correlate to the field. I think the more important thing is throw the right environments. You know, if temperature matters, make sure temperature is part of your test. If vibration matters, make sure it's part of it. But don't spend too much test time or engineering energy on, you know, a well-defined test. Just make sure you're throwing the right environments at the product. Give the product a chance to fail.
Yeah,
is how I usually put it. And then on the quantitative side, it's really just the opposite. And I think you brought that up as well, that you need to think about that your test plans, you know, because you're going to make some claim about, you know, I meet R97 C70, but, you know, that's a meaningless number if your tests are not meaningful. Your tests need to correlate to customer usage. In fact, you know, a well-defined test plan, a quantitative test plan, will also have some mention of what percentile user, is this a median user type of exposure, or is it 97th percentile? So where are you in that continuum, if you will?
Yeah. Let's take a moment for a break. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Fred here. Are you considering becoming an ASQ certified reliability engineer, or just interested in expanding your reliability engineering skill set? Mastering the full body of knowledge takes deliberate practice, which means you need a guide and feedback, a coach. The online and on-demand CRE prep course, along with my personal support, will help you pass the exam and improve your reliability skill set. To get started, go to ascendoreliability.com/go/CRE.
So yeah, John, we just were talking about with the use cases, you know, what percentile of the actual use population of field are you representing? And I think that's a really important discussion to itself, because if you are making statements in a quantitative manner and you've created a couple different use cases, you know, how the nominal person uses it or the, you know, the easiest or the hardest, you obviously don't want to have your test protocol be based on the nominal use case, because that means technically 50% of the population is using it harder than that. So you're not going to be creating a design that is, you know, going to be successful. But you also don't want to pick the absolute hardest possible use case, because you might probably end up over designing the product and making it too expensive, or product development times too long, where it's okay to have a small percentage failure rate for that.
Right.
So that's tricky. So you do have to, you know, pick, all right, we want to do about a 95th percentile. It's okay if the 5% of the people use it harder, you know, and we only expect a X percentage of them to have an issue. And I call this the, I call this the midlife crisis use case. Actually I wrote an article about it. This will come out long after the article, but I call it the midlife crisis use case because, it's, let's say your testing only allows you to test one use case, you know, which one do you pick? So you being an automotive, you can relate to this. So if you characterized your customers, you know, for a car, you know, you have a car, let's say you could have four. You could have your little old lady who, you know, never even goes on the highway, just very slow driving around, brakes really easy, accelerates really easy. Okay, there's your one use case. Then you have, you know, what I would call the punk-ass kid whose parents bought him the car. He doesn't care. He wants to impress his friends all the time, does burnouts, you know, will drive a gazillion hours and didn't know you're supposed to do oil changes. You know, you'll have the soccer mom one, right, where she does a good mix of start and stop traffic, you know, does mix in 50% highway driving, you know, doesn't accelerate and brakes pretty normally, the occasional hard braking when she's, you're not paying attention, has to slam on the brakes like we all do. But then if you only could do one use case, what would you do? You can't pick the old lady one because you're likely not to discover the true robustness under the other use cases. You can pick the soccer mom one, but there are people who are going to use it harder than her. And you're not going to capture that. So the ideal one is the midlife crisis use case. This is the 50-year-old gentleman who's always wanted a Mustang, finally buys one for himself. He spends 90% of his time just commuting back and forth to work on the highway and doing, you know, the around-the-town taxi driver thing for his kids, right? We just start and stop traffic, take them to soccer practice, take them to here, take them to there. But then on Saturdays when he meets up with his buddies, he does an occasional burnout or something just to impress them, you know.
Yes.
So, you know, that's that use case, if you study that guy, that's probably a pretty good one if you only had the test one to test, right? You capture a little bit of everything. So I think that's sometimes you have to do that.
Would you consider the midlife crisis scenario say 95th percentile or not quite that high? I mean, just generally speaking, it's
yeah, exactly.
I would, rent, right?
Yeah, I would say that without studying it, yeah, you could say that that's, you know, you could only, I mean, I guess in your mind, that what percentage of people do you expect are going to use that vehicle much harder than him? And so, you know, you and I, you know, just being somebody who uses that, you know, we use cars, we, you know, you work in the car industry, I've worked in, you know, industries associated to it. And you could say, yeah, I could picture 5% of people using it much harder. You have a few punk ass kids that use it. You have a few people that maybe live in a very rural area where it's a constantly bumpy road. And, you know, or you have people who just drive it only downtown with really horrendous start and stop traffic where you get tons of braking and acceleration. But yeah, I would say that if you did a study, you probably could say that that's a reasonable 95%. I think it's fine to aim for that too, because it doesn't mean those that whole other 5% that you're not accounting for are going to have failures. It just means, you know, that's where you don't know and haven't measured the robustness of the product.
Yeah,
and
there's always one of the reasons you're not higher than that. It's the cost benefit ratio, right? I mean, it does come at a cost to design your product at those higher levels. The other thing is, you know, you say 95th percentile, but usually, you know, in engineering, test reliability and product engineering, you know, there's a level of conservatism that, you know, we say 95th percentile, but we're always erring on the side of being conservative. So, you know, in the end, I think we end up doing, you know, testing a little more severely than that.
Yeah, it's true. And then also you direct them to other products, right? Because there's the people who are using their car in those very rural areas where really you should be directing them to your truck product line, right? Which is designed for that. You know, right. It does capture that whole group there. So to your point, you wouldn't want to design the car to satisfy that. The car, it's totally reasonable for somebody to drive a car totally on dirt roads. You can't tell a customer they can't. But you're also not going to design to that to, you know, make the suspension be able to handle constant hammering. And, you know, it's going to wear out sooner than you expect, maybe within warranty. And you say, okay, fine, we'll pay that percentage of warranty cost for the few people who bought our sedan, you know, and used it in those conditions first.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And that's a better business strategy. That's why I said before, you know, you want to connect it to the business strategy, because that's, you know, that at the end of the day is what drives the decisions.
Yeah, you know, the other place that this percentile user kind of comes into play, you know, when I was a newer reliability engineer, one question I would get a lot was, all right, so our reliability spec that we just met was, let's say, R96 C whatever, C70. So does that mean that 4% of our products will fail in the field? And, you know, I struggled with that early, but, you know, really the answer to that is no, because, you know, in the field, you know, you get all, you know, users of all types, but on our test plan is designed around the 95th percentile user for, let's say, for example. So it's that high percentile user that is what guarding you, protecting you from having 4% failure when you're only meeting a 96 percentile reliability, or I'm sorry, a 96% reliability spec.
Yeah. And you have to remember too that unless you're actually measuring beyond that 95th percentile, you don't know. It might perform fantastic, you know, far beyond it. So right. It's, you know, all you're saying is that we've only measured to the 95th percentile. We're not saying it's only good to that, you know, unless you have measured beyond and you know, did find out where it does, you know, what is the margin or what is the life cycles or all that. But unless you've done that, you're just saying it's 95 or greater. You're not, you know, so, yeah. So it's definitely, it definitely, again, brings up a lot of good questions to be asked when you do, you know, create a quantitative phase like that in the program. And it's, you know, it's interesting. We're just even asking the question has so much value because discussions occur that wouldn't have occurred otherwise.
Yeah. And you learn a lot about your product. You learn a lot about your application, right? When you're doing quantitative work, if you're trying to create meaningful tests, then you're talking to your customer, you're putting instrumentation on customer devices on your products in the customer's hands. So just the process of, you know, creating these tests that are meaningful, you're learning a lot about your product. And then, of course, it just makes your reliability tests more meaningful as well when your tests are meaningful.
Yep.
But I think the other thing we haven't mentioned yet, though, in terms of a quantitative demonstration is that the parts, you know, when you're whatever your sample size is, and whether it's a success test or a test to failure, it's important that the parts be representative, contain all the variation that is expected to be seen in manufacturing. So, the way I like to put it is the tests need to be meaningful, but so do the parts.
Yeah, yeah, and that is a killer too, because, you know, quantitative testing like reliability growth programs, you know, accelerated life test programs that are doing measurement for life take a long time. So to say we're only going to, you know, we're not going to make a full statement until we have the final production equivalent parts. I mean, at that point, people are ready to release the product. It's definitely a hard thing. And then it's also hard if you've done it with an earlier iteration of the design to be able to argue that this is a valid statement any longer. So yeah, that's a very hard negotiation.
Yeah, it sure is. That's why they pay the reliability engineers so much, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, good. Well, that was a really great discussion. Well, thank you, John. I'm glad you brought up the topic. And to any of our listeners, we'd love to see your comments or questions, you know, on this, and your experiences, you know, share them, because it's without a doubt something that's a big discussion in every program design. Okay, great. Well, thank you, John.
Yeah, very good. I enjoyed it, Adam. Thanks.
It was good. All right, take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.